know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, baby. Come on.
Say you will.
Say it better, yeah.
Say you will.
Come on now. Say that you love me. Say that you need me. Say that you want me. You want
live
me.
From New York City, it's the Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles.
I still remember.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about a study from Thomas Jefferson University about N-acetylcysteine could help Parkinson's disease patients, published in the Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics, and about 12 other important original scientific studies, always published in peer-reviewed journals from respected institutions, but cutting edge. The things you're not going to see in the mainstream media. A little later in the program, we're going to hear from Dr. Suzanne Humphrey's new information on aluminum and what it does inside your body that it shouldn't ever be in your body to have a chance to do. But to give additional support, you're going to hear for the first time from a Dr. Sin Hang Lee. He is going to talk about the cover-up and health risks of the human papilloma vaccine Gardasil. And by the way, he's more than qualified. He has multiple degrees. He also was at Cornell Medical Hospital, Sloan Kettering. He is board certified by the American Board of Pathology. And also from 1968, for nearly 40 years, he taught as a professor of pathology at both McGill University in Montreal and Yale University. And he also has served as pathologist in hospitals. So he has a lot of good information that you have not heard before. And I suggest that if you are aware of a vaccine-injured person, speak out to their parents now and tell them to listen in. This is very important information for the lawyers who represent, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and what's her name, Finn. Listen in today. This is new information, and this is an exclusive on our program. Then we're going to go to some audio clips in addition, including a Harvard lawyer's vaccine-injured son. It's a short clip where he gave a testimony, and our democracy no longer represents the people. Larry Lessig, Harvard professor, says, here's how we can fix it. I don't know I'll get to all this. We'll get to as much as we can. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. And in that context, we're going to look at what Thomas Jefferson University says. They did a randomized trial recently, just a month ago, and it shows that there's an association between the amino acid N-acetylcysteine, that's NAC, and improvements in patients with Parkinson's disease. And most people understand that that disease is characterized by a loss of function of the brain's dopamine-producing neurons. And N-acetylcysteine acts as a precursor to the amino acid L-cysteine, which in turn is a precursor to the antioxidant glutathione. So this is all working together to help Parkinson's patients, and they didn't use a large amount. They use 500 milligrams orally twice a day, or 1,000 milligrams. I generally double that in people I'm working with Parkinson's. In any case, they receive the N-acetylcysteine, and dopamine transporter binding significantly increased in two areas of the brain's basal ganglia. That's the region of the brain that is most affected by Parkinson's. And by the end of the treatment period, the treated group also experienced improvements in physical and mental function. So, good news all the way around. Now, from the Institute of Industrial Research comes another study on green tea. It showed it reduces your blood sugar in diabetics. That's good news. since we have nearly 100 million diabetic and pre-diabetics in the United States. And once again, it was the catechins, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N-S, and they're in the green tea, and also what is called ECG, the epicatechin gallate, and the EGCG. These are the natural combined chemicals that are released when you have green tea in your blood, and they help to kind of like mop up the free radicals, and they're strong antioxidants, and then it stabilizes your blood sugar. And that prevents your DNA from being adversely affected and allows telomerase activity and the cell cycle progression, and also promoting cancer cells to self-destruct. It's a very powerful anti-inflammatory. From Anhui University in China and Harvard University, protect your liver with whole grains. Well, the study finds that it reduces the risk of liver cancer. So all of you healthy vegans who are eating a healthy plant-based diet, eating whole grains, there's your brown rice and your millet and your quinoa, right? These all important. It offers a wide range of health benefits, which include protecting against liver cancer. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Journal of Oncology. And if you stick to a whole grain diet, you can lower your risk of liver cancer by 40%, 4-0. That's huge. Just with one dietary change, you're also going to drop your cholesterol level. You're going to protect yourself against obesity. You're going to help prevent diabetes. You're going to help non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, all of which are risk factors for primary liver cancer or hepatocellular carcinoma. In addition to reducing insulin resistance and regulating your metabolism and reducing inflammation, and just by regularly consuming whole grains and dietary fiber, you also have healthier microbiota, the good bacteria in your gut. So, that's good. Also, apple polyphenol supplementation enhances antioxidant capacity and improves lipid metabolism. This is from Sichuan Agriculture University in China. Now, I've mentioned many times that the most powerful part of an apple is in its skin. So if you really want to lower your cholesterol and help the good bacteria in your body and help the collagen with the amount of quercetin that's in apples and onions, take the skin. You can juice the apple. You don't have to waste that. But then take the skin of four apples and throw it in a blender and blend it up. Terrific for you. And those polyphenols are also helping improve your fat. Lipid means fat. So it's controlling your blood lipids, keeping your cholesterol down. From Harvard University, published in Frontiers in Physiology, red wine's resveratrol, trol, three syllables, resveratrol, that could help keep you strong and helps your bones. And that's important. That's one of a lot of things it does. And that's very important for strengthening our muscles and our bones as they weaken. Weight-bearing muscles are first, and they're the first to get hit and the worst when you have any atrophy or you're in a gravity-free situation. So people who are bedridden, people that have trouble walking, resveratrol can make a difference and help you. Also from the University of Tanta, which is in Egypt, comes a study about selenium, the micromineral, generally 200 micrograms a day. It can help with polycystic ovary syndrome. That's important. And by the way, PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, is the most common endometrial pathology in fertile women with heterogeneous reproductive and metabolic phenotypes of unknown etiology. So it does make a difference. It's natural, it's non-toxic in the amounts given. From the University of Queensland, which is in Australia, published in the Lancet Psychiatric Journal, a body-mind need care in mental illness, and an 18-year-old life expectancy gap between people with mental illness and the general population can only be bridged by protecting patients' physical and mental health, according to this study. Now think of that. 18-year gap. You're going to live 18 years shorter life if you have mental illness, or what they call mental illness. Much of it is not an illness. There are brain chemical imbalances, but not due to deficiency of the psychiatric drugs. You can have brain damage from vaccines, from environmental factors, from genetics, from having parents that were not aware of the importance of health, might have been smoking and drinking, and you become preterm, or the parents suffer from eclampsia, almost miscarriage, but not quite, so you're born, but you're born with defects. So there's a lot of different reasons for a child to develop with a poor learning spectrum. They're not learning at certain points when they should be: speaking, responding, eye contact, laughing, crawling, walking. And as a result, there's some damage there. So one of the things that this is saying is that you have to pay attention if that child becomes diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder, or as an adult they have a psychiatric disorder, because more often than not, they're not going to be getting the nutrition that they require, and that contributes to them living a shorter life. TCM, herbal formula, Yang He Ho Yan, can prevent mammary tumorigenesis. This is from Shandong University in China. Now, I realize you probably don't know how to spell that. Let me spell it for you. The first word, Yang. The second one, He. The third, Hua. The fourth, Yan. This is a combination used in traditional Chinese medicine. And according to this study, which was published in the British Medical Journal of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, it can make a difference. It is a natural chemo-preventative potential of this Chinese herbal concoction. So wouldn't it be nice to realize that there are safe and effective chemo-preventative agents, and they're as effective in reducing morbidity and mortality of breast cancer than traditional treatments? So that's important. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back and continue on. We have a lot to share today. Please stay with us.
We got it together, didn't we? We've definitely got our thing together, don't we? Isn't that nice? I mean, really, when you really sit and think about it, isn't it really, really nice? I can easily feel myself slipping more. Nobody but you.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. I'm going to give you a heads up on a new scientific journal in scientific research, and it's by a Thomas Prevenzik from Germany, Berlin, Germany. The article is entitled "The Causal Link Between Vaccination Adjuvants and Autism." This is important because it's a really well-done article, and the conclusions state emphatically that there is an association between aluminum adjuvants and what it does in the body, and then what it does in conclusion. Quote, DNA damage to the immune system as the causal link between vaccination adjuvants, meaning aluminum, and autism is based upon UV radiation emitted from NP, but the UV radiation also activates antigens in the immune system that enhance the effectiveness of the vaccination. DNA damage and activation of the immune system is delicately balanced, providing the immune system repair is not overwhelmed by UV-induced DNA damage. Otherwise, continued DNA damage of the impaired immune system may lead to autism. Wow. So, one more article showing the connection between autism spectrum disorder and vaccines. And mind you, we have a lot of these. This is not the only one. And this person had impeccable credentials. Now we're going to go to two other people talking on this subject. The first is going to be a lawyer from Harvard University talking about his child and what happened once he took the vaccines.
Native California.
Okay, we've
California,
seen
have a... Native California. I got my undergraduate degree from Harvard University. I'm an attorney, and I practice education law. I'm also a proud father of a severely vaccine-injured child. I'm here. I'd like to tell you a minute or two about my boy. He was our firstborn, perfectly healthy at birth, hitting all of his milestones. As first-time parents, we were very conscious about hitting all his pediatrician visits and staying on schedule. At 4 months, we took him in for his scheduled dose of vaccines. That evening, we took him home. He had a 104-degree fever. He screamed inconsolably for hours and vomited. He had never been sick before. Shortly thereafter, he started having seizures. We rushed him to the hospital where they started him on a drug called phenobarbital, which controlled the seizures. His development resumed, and at our next pediatrician visit, which is around 7 months old, my wife and I had prepared to confront our doctor and say, look, Clayton had this reaction last time. He's developed epilepsy. He's on medication. We'd like to wait till he's a little older before getting his next round of vaccines. Our pediatrician pushed back. She pressed us. She assured us there was no connection between his epilepsy and the seizures and the vaccines that he had received at 4 months. She went further, and she said that because he was having health problems, he was at greater risk of being exposed, and that we could even, she suggested it be irresponsible for us not to stay on schedule with him. Against our instincts, we went ahead and had him vaccinated on schedule. Shortly after that, his seizures returned with a vengeance. He seized so much that he entered into a medical state, which is called status epilepticus. It's when the brain is in a state of continuous seizure. We rushed him to the hospital. That episode was the last time we heard our son's voice for 3 years. He collapsed after 45 minutes of seizing, and when he finally woke up, he had lost the ability to respond to sound. Like I said, he no longer used his voice. And over the next several months, we saw a dramatic mental regression in our son. It was after that my wife and I did research and learned about Congress in the late 1980s passing the National Childhood Injury Vaccine Program and Act, which has been referred to. We learned that vaccines are not safe for all kids and that there's very little in terms of screening that can be done to determine which kids will have a reaction like Clayton's and which kids will have no reaction. Clayton's 13 years old today. My wife and I wanted him to be here for this. He seizes every day. Saturday night, he had 37 grand mal seizures, so he's currently in Children's Hospital in L.A., but he's here with me in spirit. She finally decided to have a daughter, so Clayton has a 9-year-old sister. She's perfectly healthy. She's never been vaccinated because we live in fear that we've got some genetic predisposition that could give her a similar reaction.
No, you don't have a genetic predisposition in all probability. It is the vaccine and the aluminum adjuvants in that vaccine that cause this. Now, you're a lawyer. You're capable from Harvard. You're capable of doing serious research. Here is the problem. The problem is that we have a professional class in the United States of highly educated, successful, driven people, motivated, and lawyers, doctors, CPAs, scientists, professors, heads of businesses and corporations. Now, these people have the resources, either directly or through their staff, to get any information they need. So why is it one of the most important things in the world, you're putting all forms of viruses and bacteria into your body, known toxic agents, not one of them has ever been proven good for your body, and you didn't do a single piece of research. You go out and buy a car and think of all the questions you're going to ask about its transmission and warranty and its safety, and you ask nothing about the vaccines. You're trusting. And unfortunately, where I can understand why people trust, think about the consequences when you trust and something happens and no one owns up to it. There's collective denialism. That's serious. So that we don't want anymore. So unfortunately, the only time we hear from these people is after the fact. 7 million Americans minimally right now are suffering after the fact. They believe their doctor, they want to be good citizens, they want to do what was right, and they didn't resist. They got in line and allowed themselves or their children to be vaccinated with deadly consequences. Later, my guests will discuss this. Now we're going to hear from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Now, she was a pro-vaccine person, and she was a 2 board certifications, including nephrology. She was very dedicated to orthodoxy. And then the evidence became so overwhelming, it forced her reluctantly to look for the truth. And she found it. And now she has done more research than just about anyone I know. Maybe Dr. Tony Barker, Dr. Nancy Banks, a few people have done about the same amount of research, probably up around 20,000 hours. And yet, no one in the media will ever have her on. And she won't be allowed to testify before Congress. But the Paul Offits, yeah. The people who are pro-vaccine, no problem. Here's what she had to say. Now, it's a long piece. It's 32 minutes. We'll play about 10 minutes of it. And the rest of it you can download off our site.
Do end up in the vaccine media, but we're told not to worry about it because they're only slightly tumorigenic. And that's the flu vaccines. We know that there is human material, fetal material in vaccines. They're also used, lung fibroblasts are used to propagate. Now think about it. If you need to propagate vats and vats of vaccine in order to make it for the entire world, you need to have cells that divide really rapidly so that you can grow viruses on or that you can have bacteria growing on. So that's why we need these cells in order to make the vaccines. Okay, they don't just make themselves. So this chick is also really cute, but it's not really cute necessarily when it's injected into you, and we know that it's a very common substrate for vaccine production. This one here I find rather disturbing. That is a caterpillar, and that is used for the Cervarix human papillomavirus vaccine, is used propagated through genetic engineering with that caterpillar cell. And these monkeys, again, this has been part and parcel of vaccine production since the earliest times, because these monkey cells, they divide really rapidly and they grow viruses. The polio vaccines are made on them. We still have vaccines made on them today. There have been lots of problems with these monkey kidney cells. Some of them have been worked out, but we don't, you know, if you don't know what can grow inside of an animal cell, you can't necessarily test for it. And even if you look on the vaccine package inserts, you'll see Vero cells listed, and that comes from monkey, and that's a monkey kidney cell. We know that there's cow blood, cow serum, albumin in vaccines, and that they also boil the hides for the gelatin that's in the vaccines as well. These little piggies here, their stomachs are used to get clumps of cells to break apart so that you can plate them out in a petri dish and grow vaccine on it. This was a problem just a few years ago. We heard about the rotavirus vaccine growing a porcine circovirus, but we were told not to worry about it because people that eat pork end up with it. So apparently it's okay to give that to your babies too. There's actually not been very much research of anything I'm aware of as far as any long-term effects of infants consuming porcine circovirus. So how do these things affect your DNA? Your child's DNA function? Well, we don't know because no one's bothered to look at the issue. But consider this. Children received 10 vaccinations in the 1980s before the age of 5. And today, they get 36 vaccines, beginning often in utero or on the first day of life, like we do in the United States. Human brains and human immune systems have definitely changed for the worse, and vaccines can be playing a part. Epigeneticists and vaccinologists say, well, vaccines can train the immune system through epigenetic reprogramming, and they want us to look on the bright side. They always want to paint a picture of how the immune system is going to be improved because of this. But that's not what we see, and that's not what much of the medical literature states. Even if vaccines can prevent some infections, considering what's in them, there's no way they can improve overall health. And now they want to give vaccines to pregnant women, which in addition to these animal cells and associated genetic material, also have aluminium in them. And you can see here Dr. Paul Offit, and he's the doctor that I mentioned in the beginning, who says that infants can tolerate 100,000 vaccines at once, theoretically, although there's never been any animal model for that. That's his theory. Well, in the context of medical literature, it's astonishing that one of the most well-published vaccine proponents, Paul Offit, and he's a key opinion person who's the go-to soundbite for the American pro-vaccine movement, that he could publish this on his website. He educates doctors worldwide on vaccination. And on his website, from the Children's Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, the Vaccine Education Center, in April of 2013, you could have gone on there and read about your concerns about aluminium in pregnancy, and you could have been totally set at ease by seeing what this website had to say, because this quote was on his website, and it said, "Aluminium is considered to be an essential metal with quantities fluctuating naturally during normal cellular activity. It is found in all tissues and also believed to play an important role in the development of a healthy fetus." Well, I PDF'd that web page in April 2013, and I sent it with a link to one of the world's most knowledgeable aluminium experts, who's usually very diplomatic and polite. And he wrote me back stating something not very flattering about Dr. Paul Offit, which I won't repeat here. But wouldn't you think that a man who considers himself highly educated would have read this following quote that was published in 2011? Dr. Kawahara published a very important article that needs to be read by anybody who has concerns about aluminium. And amongst other things in that article, in the very beginning, he says, "Whilst being environmentally abundant, aluminium is not essential for life. On the contrary, aluminium is a widely recognized neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in plants, animals, and humans." He goes into great detail about this. All the other aluminium researchers I know have no time for Dr. Paul Offit's comments. We need to look at vaccines in pregnancy more closely, starting with aluminium, to see what it really does do in the body. Dr. Kawahara's article is very important because it supports, with 176 medical references, the fact that aluminium is a death factor for cells. He reviews the most state-of-the-art techniques that have brought aluminium back to the forefront of Alzheimer's research and tells why and how the old research that said it wasn't related to Alzheimer's is flawed. This picture denotes some of the problems that he has documented and found himself with the action of aluminium in the body. Now remember, the aluminium is a small radius, very highly positively charged element. So it's going to be attracted to negative charges in the body. Because of that, it's able to travel to places where it really should never go. One of those places is into the brain. And we now know that it does cross the blood-brain barrier. It crosses in cells called macrophages, and there are special transport systems that shuttle it through. We also know that aluminium binds to phosphate in DNA and RNA in the nucleus. Remember all that epigenetic stuff? Well, guess what? When that binds to phosphates in the nucleus, it influences many genes and regulates in abnormal ways gene function. We also know that it binds to ATP. That stands for adenosine triphosphate, which you may have heard of, as it's the most important energy molecule in your body. And that's what's used to give, you know, for me to move my muscle right now, or for you to run up a hill. That's what you need. Well, aluminium binds to that and influences energy metabolism. And we know that people with aluminium excess end up with very low energy. This also here is an enzyme, and that's calcium or magnesium. And you should know that enzymes are dependent upon certain elements. And in order for them to function properly and have the right conformation, they need these elements. Well, because aluminium is such a highly negatively charged particle, it actually has more of an affinity for those enzymes than the normal elements that are supposed to be working with it. So it comes in, pops calcium and magnesium right off, and takes over and essentially inhibits those enzymes. Without enzymes, your metabolism really can't work very well. In addition to making those enzymes useless, the fact that it's now bound onto them keeps it in the body longer. So this makes the half-life of aluminium even longer. Over here, we see this is an example of a protein. And we know that proteins are supposed to, for the most part, be separate, doing their jobs. And when the aluminium comes along, it cross-links them. It essentially works as a tanning agent because it coagulates proteins in this way. And it causes conformational change. And having the right shape in a protein is really important because the shape often determines its function. So those conformational changes can actually inhibit the degradation of those proteins by their particular proteases. So you can't actually even use them the way you...
She doesn't sound like a person who is uninformed about vaccines. Do you believe that your pediatrician or your pharmacist or your general practitioner could give the advice and insight that she just shared with you in about 7 minutes of a 20-some minutes statement? No. That's the difference of being informed properly. We'll go into this in a little bit. But first, I want to thank my friend Steve Brown, who sent me this quote from a person. The Democratic Party is less a political party in pursuit of particular policy goals than a professional association organized to defend and advance the careers of its most valued members. Well said, Osita Nwanver, you, or I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name, Nwanevu. But I appreciate that, Steve. And I want to share a few additional insights before we go to a guest. And I began it yesterday, but I did not have an opportunity because of the length of the program to share all of it. But it is my opinion, as well as Professor Henry Giroux, that we have already fully immersed ourselves into neoliberal policies as a nation. Individuals will resist it and can live apart from it, but the average person doesn't realize that how embracing of this neoliberalism they are, how much they have allowed the corporatization of everything, like the Internet of Everything, to imbue their own life. I remember going down to Occupy a Wall Street, and I wanted to support them. I went every day for over 3 weeks, and the first day I took my camera crew, and I wanted to see what they were about, and they were against corporatization, they were against globalization, they were against neoliberalism. I said, good for you, I support that. And then after about 20 minutes, something began to register, and there was a large group of them in a circle, and we were talking. And they were in their 20s, and I asked them about their background. They came from upper-middle-class professional backgrounds. There were a lot of professionals, and that's what I mentioned earlier in the program. The professionals are really the policymakers and opinion leaders, and yet they don't seem to be doing a lot of opinion leading when it comes to global warming or lifestyle changes that could help with the planet or in the decision of who to vote for. We should be creating third-party candidates. We're not. And they had the power to do this, and they're not using their power in a way that's really constructive. And so as I'm speaking with one of the individuals, I said, you have credit cards? Yeah, I got credit cards. Where are they? And she showed me the credit cards, and they were all corporate credit cards. I said, well, here's Citibank and J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America and American Express. These are all part of the globalization neoliberalism. And then I said, did you ever look at that little tag in your clothes? No. Well, take a look. Where's it from? And it just happened to have been from from Bangladesh. And I said, there women are paid 14 cents an hour. They have the shortest work life in the world, about 33. They're working about 15 hours a day, and they die young so that you can have cheap clothes. And then I showed her mine. I said, mine's made in the USA by union labor. And then she was eating a McDonald's. The guy beside her was drinking a Coca-Cola. They were both wearing designer blue jeans. And I said, virtually everything that you're appearing here today in, the food you're eating, the drinks you're drinking, the clothes you're wearing, the credit cards you're using, all are neoliberal. And behind neoliberalism is fascism. So are you at all aware that you're actually enabling it? And they didn't get that at all. They were very argumentative, didn't want to hear it. That's fine. But we should also understand that what happens when we don't appreciate how much we are connected to the official corporate grid of life, that as we're so connected, we've lost our individual identity. We think in groupthink. We live in group atmosphere. And under the reign of neoliberalism, this, according to Henry Giroux, the dark plague of fascism, it engulfs American society as the history of concentration camps disappear. The killing of intellectuals is forgotten. And the terror of fascist violence evaporates into the spectacle of violence accompanied by anti-intellectual blather. And this blabber becomes a part of a rampant culture of forgetting and distraction. What must be remembered here is that we are not only moral and political subjects, but also historical subjects capable of both understanding and changing the world. And it is precisely this relationship between historical consciousness and political action that points to new possibilities for change, but not in a two-party system, not in an oligarchical-controlled system, not in a corporatized system, not in a media-controlled system, not in an education system that is abiding by the rules of corporatization and identity politics. There's no positive change there. And while historical consciousness can both be informative and, let's say, emancipatory, it can also lead to malicious interpretations of the present, as well as elements of history that are difficult to accept. At the same time, historical awareness can uncover dangerous memories and narratives of those whose voices have been drowned out by those who have the power to write history, to serve their own narrow and reactionary interest. Google, Facebook, Wikipedia, they're writing history. They're creating content. They're not supposed to. They are. It is precisely in the use of critical history to offer the resources to challenge the ideological education and militant tools deployed by emerging right-wing and left-wing fascistic groups that their toxic use of history in the present can be challenged. In this instance, any radical social movement needs a historical informed notion of struggle that is solidly on the side of a strong anti-capitalist movement. Resistance is no longer an option given that both the humanity and the life of the planet are at stake. If you doubt me, then look at this conundrum. We are trying to keep from approaching 2 degrees Celsius increase, but we're almost there. And this year, China, India, and the United States are leading in increasing industrialization, urbanization, and the creation of CO2 and methane. So we're racing towards that goal instead of trying to resist that goal. That is how this happens and a planet becomes at stake. American society has turned lethal, as is evident in its assaults upon poor children, undocumented immigrants, and those considered disposable by virtue of their race and ethnicity and religion and color. In an age when historical memory either disappears or is rewritten in the language of erasure and misrepresentation, too many people look away and become complicit with diverse forms of fascism emerging across the globe. Regimes of fear destroy standards of truth, creating easy paths for warmongers and racists and misogynists and nativists to take advantage of a comatose public, one I call intentionally negligent, which leads to intentional ignorance, which leads to unintended consequences that are disastrous. And neoliberal fascism, a new social and political formation that combines the savage consequences of economic inequality and the politics of survival with the dictates of ultranationalism and white supremacy, took hold in the 1970s and has become a powerful engine of violence and cruelty both in the United States and in the increasing number of other countries. So neoliberal fascism is the enemy of revisionist forms of history because it disdains any resource that can be used to hold power accountable and translate past events into a form of moral witnessing in the present. I just think it's important we know this. I'll share more on upcoming programs. All right? We're going to go to our guest in a moment. However, before we go to our guest, I'm going to offer the people in this audience something very nice. And something just, it was, I heard someone say in a discussion, we need more love in the world. I don't agree. I believe that we have abundance of love as a natural extension of our natural spiritual self. It's just to liberate it, to come out of being motivated by fear and uncertainty, and to see how much love there is and connect with it. Like, we have an abundance of good people. We have abundance of opportunity. We have abundance of imaginative people not afraid to put their ideas forth. But not a lot of people get this. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to my guest, then I'm going to come back and give you a little offering at the end of the show. But right now, let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. I gave you his introduction earlier on at the beginning of the show. He is Dr. Sinhang Lee, and he's up in Milford, Connecticut. And he is going to discuss with us the cover-up and health risks the human papilloma vaccine Gardasil. Nice to have you with us today. Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Thank you for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you, Gary.
We had you on several years ago when you performed preliminary studies that indicated Gardasil as a possible cause of death in girls who received the HPV vaccine. You may recall that a former Merck physician and French doctor predicted that Gardasil may turn out to be the greatest medical scandal of all times, and you have investigated the deaths of girls who received the vaccine, as has Christopher Shaw and Lucia Tomlevich at the University of British Columbia. Well, right now, we are witnessing several countries, such as Japan, Italy, and Ireland, conducting investigations over Gardasil's safety record. And Gardasil is a very complex vaccine. It is genetically unlike any other vaccine on the market. Your research has focused on the genetic sequencing of the HPV strains used in the vaccines. My understanding is that some of these strains are not natural, rather they have been genetically engineered. So perhaps you can begin by explaining how these strains are different than those found in the wild infection and why this might be a reason why vaccine injuries from Gardasil are more severe than from other vaccines. The forum is yours.
Yes. The Gardasil vaccination depends on using a purified HPV L1 protein as an antigen. As all the purified proteins, when they are injected into the human body, the human body do not see it as a danger. So there's no need to produce antibody against the purified protein. So it needs an adjuvant to boost the immunogenicity, to increase the antibody production against the virus protein in the body. And so they use a special adjuvant. It's called aluminum adjuvant. Aluminum adjuvant has been used for more than 80 years, to boost vaccination effectiveness. But the mechanism is unknown, it's speculated. Until very recently, people found that it needs something else to combine with aluminum. It is called toll-like receptor agonist. This is or ligand to combine with it. And in HPV vaccine Cervarix, the bivalent HPV vaccine, this toll-like receptor 4 agonist is derived from a salmonella, a gram-negative organism. It's called phospholipid, monophosphoryl lipid. To bind it, it's called adjuvant AS04. This is listed on the vaccine pamphlet. Now, for Gardasil 4 or 9, they have not identified a toll-like receptor agonist equivalent to the phospholipid in Cervarix. So I found that the HPV DNA fragments in Gardasil 4 and Gardasil 9 are equivalent to the toll-like receptor agonist, but it is called toll-like receptor agonist. The toll-like receptor 9, the DNA, the HPV DNA, the viral DNA fragments.
Okay, doctor, this is a little too complicated for a lay audience.
Yeah, right.
I need you to keep it simple, not chemical. I'd like you to briefly discuss what are the most serious adverse effects of Gardasil that seem to be certain based upon the scientific evidence and your own research in studying tissue samples of girls who have been injured from the vaccine?
Yeah. The most serious concern is a sudden unexpected death. Okay. One of the fourteen-year-old teenager football player training in California that died of sudden death at night in sleep. Okay, and I reviewed the case and I helped the lawyer to ask for compensation for the boy who died suddenly. It's on the internet. The boy's name is Gomez, in the Gomez case, and the boy died of myocardial infarction, like an old man suffering MI. And so I think that it was related to Gardasil complication because it affects the myocardial function, causing ischemia in the heart, causing myocardial infarction. And the teenagers usually are very healthy population compared to the newborn and old age people. And usually they don't die suddenly. So that's the myocardial damage is one of the complications I'm concerned about. It. And also the brain damage. The first I was involved in the case was because a girl, 16 years old girl in Hartford, and who received the 2 injections of Gardasil and developed blindness, and the biopsy showed the disseminated myelitis infection in the brain. So this is how I got involved in the vaccine research.
Okay, in the simplest lay terms, explain how aluminum salt, the adjuvant, that's the aluminum is put in there to make the vaccine more potent, and there's a growing body of scientific research such as Dr. Chris Isley's work in the United Kingdom showing aluminum adjuvant's role in neurological disorders is actually bound to the vaccine viral component. And also the way this adjuvant has been engineered has not been approved by any federal regulatory authorities, nor has any research on its safety been conducted. or at least far as we know. Why should we be wary concerning this, and how has your own research shown any specific risks for cause of vaccine injury from the engineered adjuvant of aluminum?
Okay. All the antigens used for the vaccine are produced in yeast fungus for Gardasil and produce it. So it has to be a genetical engineer in order for the DNA to be inserted into the fungus to produce the protein, the first place. And number two is that the residual DNA bound to the aluminum becomes non-B conformation. It cannot be degraded. It acts like a long-term persistent stimulator for the immune system in order to maintain the high level of antibody production. And that is the problem for certain people. The reaction is unusually high. And when the macrophages get into different places, like in the heart, in the brain, then it may cause a serious complication. Because the DNA is in non-B conformation. It cannot be degraded. Usually when you have DNA get into the body, the enzymes will chop up the DNA, degrade the DNA, and excrete from the urine. But this kind of DNA, when they bound to the aluminum, and it cannot be degraded, and it acts in the macrophages, cause long-term, very potent stimulation in the macrophages.
Okay. My final question is this. There was a study out of Sweden published in a respected peer-reviewed journal, but it was quickly retracted because its conclusions were that the human papilloma vaccine may be contributing to cervical cancer due to the country's health ministry noting a substantial increase in cervical cancer in the girls that received the vaccine. Now, this increase paralleled the introduction of the vaccine into the nation's vaccination schedule. Also, you submitted your own research paper about aluminum-bound human papilloma strains in the Gardasil 9 vaccine to a prestigious journal, Vaccines. But it was rejected without having gone through any peer review. It was first recommended by the chief editor for review, but that never happened. What was the main discovery in your paper, and why did they reject it?
Yeah, that is why. See, why did they reject it? I'm still communicating with the publisher, Dr. Lin. Yeah, and I said that the chief, the editor in chief, actually ordered my paper to be sent out for peer review, but someone in the editorial board just suppressed it and it did not follow the order and it rejected my paper. And I have communicated with the publisher. And now in the process, I hope that the concerned citizens would write to the publisher and ask for explanation why the paper was rejected without peer review.
Okay, we're going to do that ourselves. We have an article that we're presenting tomorrow. We're releasing it tomorrow. And showing how unscientific scientific journals are, how much politics is involved with control of that politics coming from the pharmaceutical industry. We're out of time, but I just want you to know that there are those of us who are looking at your work. How many articles have you published in the peer-reviewed journal until this article?
Oh, in the same journal groups, I published maybe 6 or 7 articles in this group of journals. And this only article that was rejected without peer review.
And how many other articles have you published?
Altogether in my lifetime?
Yes.
On my CV, I published 74 articles, scientific articles.
Okay, so here we have it, a highly respected academic, having been on the faculty and taught at Yale and McGill Universities both, having published 74 articles in peer-reviewed journal, having been acknowledged for your outstanding work, doing work on a lot of different conditions. This one article that you prove the aluminum is binding to the viral material and causing all forms of adverse health consequences, including death, that one the editor-in-chief accepts, but then someone on the board rejects it. Sounds like Dr. Cerolini with GMOs. So this is political, and we're going to fight it at that level. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. Dr. Sinhang Lee. Well, that's interesting. Again, you had a chance to hear him say, you know, I apologize, it's a little difficult to understand everything, but when you have outstanding scientists, highly respected in their field, who've never been controversial, never had a problem until they touched that third rail of vaccinations. Now, he would have found the same problem had he touched the rail for GMOs or challenging nuclear safety. There are certain hot spots that industry has fully, let's say, fully inculcated the news and scientific establishment and even in universities, that these are off limits. No, they're not, and they shouldn't be. Just a final thought here. I said I wanted to share something with you that was based upon the concept of love. I believe that we have a great deal of love, and I'm going to share a documentary that I did, one of the most popular ones in my history. I believe it was $50. I'm going to offer to you as a gift for $9.95. How about that? For 24 hours. You're going to call a number. I'm going to get the number for you in just a moment. And I want you to call this number and get what could be one of the most important documentaries, because I go into great depth about people who don't feel love, fall out of love, fall in love, are searching for love in all the wrong places, everything about love. And there are a lot of other people in the documentary as well. It's a long documentary, but it's you're saving, you know, like $50 or something. It's only $9.95 plus shipping. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and get your copy of this documentary. Watch it. See if it makes sense. See if it can help you. See if it opens up doors into the deep psyche to allow you to realize that you shouldn't be living a life without happiness and joy and expressing your love so you can receive love. But we're going to end our program today.